hear me? All right. Yeah. Let's see. Can you double click that so that you can't? Okay. Yeah, I'll go back, right? Yeah. Gotta get me one of these things. All right. In church, we usually talk about God. And this is going to be a little bit different. I always, being in a secular classroom, I always have to make a distinction saying I'm not preaching a religion, because I do a lot of religious history, but rather talking about how people deal with their concept of God. And it's not always, you know, what I think some of us would want. I'm always reminded of something that Abraham Lincoln said when somebody asked him if God was on our side during the Civil War, and he said, I don't know, but I hope we're on God's side. So, yeah, I think that's something we should all wish for. So, just giving the background, I always like to go back to, probably around the year 1100 when towns and trade and money and middle class are reviving in Western Europe, because everything pretty much changes from that. And one of the things that happens is that your kings start coming up. The middle class supports them. And so, you know, you're starting to get nation states. And the thing is that the papacy is, you know, feeling threatened by this. There's only room for one of us in this town, you know, like in the old Westerns. And so as a result, you get a clash between them. And one of these clashes was what was known as the Babylonian captivity. And what happened, you know, sort of long story short, is that the French king kidnapped Pope Boniface VIII, put him on trial for, among other things, having a pet demon. And he managed to escape, but he's kind of an old guy, and so he died. And the College of Cardinals in Rome were, like, really, sort of intimidated by these French thugs running around in the streets of Rome, so they elected a French pope, Clement V. And Clement V starts coming to Rome from Normandy and passes through an area known as Avignon, which is in France, but it's actually papal territory, and he stops there, and he never leaves. And in fact, you have seven popes that will live there, and over a period of 70 years. So this is called the Babylonian captivity, reminiscent of the 70 years that the Jews stayed in Babylon before the Persians let them go home. So anyway, this goes on for about 70 years. Then it morphs into something known as the Great Schism, where you get an Italian pope and a Roman pope, and they excommunicate each other. So everybody's excommunicated in Europe. So they call a council to, except the Jews. The Jews thought this was probably pretty funny. And then they call a council to get rid of those two popes and elect a third pope. The other two popes won't leave, so now everybody's double excommunicated. But they finally got it sorted out. And so, but this didn't do the church a whole lot of good. All right. And then with the, with the rise of towns, you get a complete change in the economy. And so the church, which is whose wealth is based on land, is falling behind. And so as a result, they get involved in a lot of corrupt practices, selling church offices, selling something called indulgences, things like that. And so this isn't doing the reputation any good either. But to be fair to the Catholic Church, it's always gone through this cycle, from the beginning, where you have people who are devout Christians, and other people see them and says, oh, yeah, they're really devout. I'll give them some money. Maybe I can, buy my way into heaven, as in the Led Zeppelin song. But then more and more money comes in, and the church gets corrupt, and people get mad. And typically, they move out into the countryside and form monasteries. And the first of them to do this was a guy named St. Anthony, who's fairly famous in a lot of art, Salvador Dali's interpretation of the Temptation of Antony, but there's all sorts of paintings like this. And other people saw what he was doing, so me too, I want to be a saint too. So they go out into the countryside, and then they start specializing in various types of torments, because it's this idea that you mortify the flesh and you elevate the spirit. So one guy lives in a pit full of poison flies, and so he'll go to heaven, of course, and somebody else starves. A lot of them starve themselves. And this one guy, Saint Simeon Stylites, lived for 30 years on top of a 60-foot pillar. And, you know, and of course he would go to heaven too for sitting on a pillar. He had, you know, it's kind of precarious up there, so he had a rope and a fence around there to keep him from falling off. There's a story that the rope embedded itself in his flesh, and the worms were eating it, and a worm fell off, and he picks it up, puts it back on, and says, you know, eat what God has given you. So that's sort of the mindset that you have. And wow, look, you know, he's up on a pillar. So everybody's like, for 1,200 years, you have people sitting on pillars. You know, it's the early flagpole sitters, except, you know, at least they're sensible enough not to wait for the Cleveland Indians to win a World Series. But the thing is, so you have all of this going on. And then it goes to the west. And so there's a picture of St. Benedict, who tried to purge himself from thinking about girls by throwing himself in a thorn bush, which is probably pretty effective. I don't know if I would recommend that, but and what one finds a lot of times with Saint Benedict, we'll find it with Luther, you find it with Saint Ignatius Loyola, find it with Buddha, is that people will just like really torment themselves and then realize, you know, this is not getting the job done. It's a dead end, maybe literally. And so then they come to sort of a middle path and they realize, well, let's have something more moderate. So St. Benedict starts the Benedictine monasteries, which are much more moderate. You know, it's like 8 hours of work, 8 hours of devotion, 8 hours of rest and contemplation. And as a result, that spreads, and then you go back to that cycle of corruption and reform with Cistercians and the Cluniacs and so on and so forth. So Luther's really part of that that cycle, and he sees himself as such. Luther, when he posts his 95 Theses, is a loyal son of the church. He's not trying to break away from the church, but push turns to shove, and so that's what happens. All right, while this is going on, and we have a little something called the Hundred Years' War, little unless you're French or you're English, I guess. But the thing is that with the French popes in Avignon, the English don't like the French. So they don't like French popes. So this gives an opening to a guy by the name of John Wycliffe, who's an Oxford scholar who goes through the Bible and, you know, comes to the decision or the conclusion that if it's not in the Bible, then we shouldn't be doing it, okay? Because over the previous 1,300 years, the church had added more and more sort of practices and things like that. And so, you know, he was saying, well, Jesus didn't own property, so why should the church own property? And he didn't make, you know, Peter a pope. You know, maybe he made him sort of a leader, but he didn't create archbishops and bishops and a whole hierarchy of clergy that were separate from everybody else. There was no veneration of saints because none of them were saints yet. So you can't do that. Confession and penance. Jesus didn't make people confess their sins and have to do penance. And indulgences, which would get you out of purgatory, which itself was not something that Jesus talked about. So there's a lot of stuff here. And Wycliffe says, okay, let's just get back to the original religion. And something else he does is he translates the Bible into English. And the thing about the Latin Vulgate Bible was the official Bible that you've got back then. And it had been translated into Latin by St. Jerome back around the year 400, I think, 300 or 400. And in it, the idea was that, Latin and Greek for the original, or Hebrew and Greek for the original Bible, were not something understandable to Christians in the West. Latin was. So he made the Latin Vulgate Bible, which comes from Vulgus. Vulgus, we get vulgar from it, but the idea was for the common people. And things change. And if you don't adapt, then, you know, bad things happen, like dinosaurs die and things like that. And so over the next 1,300 years, Latin is kind of forgotten as a spoken language, and the Latin Vulgate Bible is just about as un, decipherable to most people as Greek and Hebrew had been. But the church, for the church, it is embedded in concrete, so they didn't want any translations. So this is a big issue with Wycliffe, and it will be with Luther as well, the idea of giving the Bible to the people so the people can understand what's in it. All right. And then my favorite invention, the printing press, which spreads ideas quickly and accurately. And I'm not going to go that whole lecture, so feel lucky there. And then the Italian Renaissance, which has a much more secular view on things. So it's breaking loose of like old ways of thinking. And then it spreads up into Northern Europe. But Northern Europe's a little bit more religious, and they believe a lot more in demons and stuff like that. And so the Northern Renaissance is somewhat religious in tone, and an awful lot of it has to do with translating the Bible from the original Greek or Hebrew into, well, Latin, or maybe even the vernacular, you know, the spoken language of the people. And this is really the atmosphere that Luther grows up in. He's very much, you know, a product of the Northern Renaissance. He's a lowly monk, but he knows his stuff, and he can debate, church opponents just in circles, because he knows, you know, what he's talking about. So this is just moving down so you can see where we left off. And then there's the political situation in Germany where Luther grows up. And so you see a map here, and it looks like somebody had just a really bad night, but that's actually a map of Germany. And Germany is broken up into something like 300 different states, and they're all semi-autonomous. They're supposedly under the rule of the Holy Roman Emperor, but the thing is that they're pretty much independent. And this has two effects. For one thing, the church can go in there and commit various abuses and that, like purgatory or indulgence sales, and they can get away with it because there's no central power to stop them from doing that, like is emerging in France and England and Spain and Portugal. The second thing is that there's also no one who can stop the spread of new ideas, such as what Luther will come up with. And so that's sort of the fatal flaw. So Germany is really, the German people are really frustrated, especially frustrated compared to other people as far as church abuses are concerned, and they're especially open to, what Luther will have to say, and the printing press will spread that around, and so, it's just, sort of a perfect storm waiting to happen. All right, so this is, when Luther gets mad. So let's look at Luther. So, this is where he was born from different perspectives. All right. These are his parents. Hans Luther is, his father. He was a peasant, I think, or he worked in copper mines, worked his way up as an entrepreneur. So he's sort of a nouveau riche. He's newly arrived in society, and people newly arrived in society a lot of times want to, really fit in with the establishment. But he also is typical of the time as far as raising kids are concerned. And so, spare the rod and spoil the child. Luther gets beat 15 times in school for misdeclining a Latin noun. I guess it would be a noun. It must have been quite a noun. But he gets beaten by his mother for stealing one nut. Nuts were really big back then. But the thing is, he grows up. His father, of course, this is the medieval idea of like God is like this angry old man up in the sky, and God is just, but Christ is merciful was a common sort of idea, or the Virgin Mary. Most people, if they want to be saved from something horrible, they want mercy, they go to the Virgin Mary to intercede to God for forgiveness and for deliverance. So, but God is like this really mean old man, and a lot of you probably went through this. I did when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I was in Sunday school, and we would sing, Yes, Jesus Loves Me, and we'll draw pictures, and Jesus has an orange face here and a purple one there, or whatever. And then one day, the Sunday school teacher says, children, if you don't believe this, you're going to burn in hell forever. This is not something you tell an 8-year-old child, okay? An 8-year-old child cannot process burning in hell forever. So then every night I'm praying, God, please don't make me burn in hell. It wasn't about the message of love and forgiveness of Jesus. It was not burning in hell, because that's just the psychology of a child. And that's kind of how Luther grows up. He wanted to be a lawyer, or his dad wanted him to be a lawyer. But one day he's walking along, gets caught in this big thunderstorm, and almost gets hit by lightning. So he prays, actually, there's all these saints. People believe that the very saints you could pray to intercede to God for you. Just like you don't go directly to the king, you go to a noble who intercedes to the king. Or if you're really evil, you don't go to the Satan, you go directly to a demon who then does that. I mean, they had all these parallel sorts of symmetries. But anyway, he promises St. Anne he'll become a monk if he gets survive this storm. And apparently he did, because we're talking about him. So what kind of a monk he made after this upbringing we're talking about is, you can see here, that he spent most of his time whipping himself, starving himself, freezing himself, and was just in a totally miserable state, which is not unusual for a lot of people back then. And he could never come to some sort of resolution, about God loving him and that. He was, he was all this self-loathing. One night he's going through the Bible, and he finds a couple passages. So these are two passages which are really essential to the Protestant faith. And basically saying, by grace and faith you're saved. It's not by works. The idea basically is we are so lowly and sinful and flagitious. That's a word that John Calvin used. I don't know what it means, but it sounds bad. So, but we were just so hopelessly sinful. There's no way we can earn our way into heaven. All right. Now, the church had a different idea. The church said, yeah, you can, but you're not going to do it here. You're probably going to have to go to purgatory. And, for maybe several million years or whatever, nobody was really sure just how long you would spend in purgatory. There wasn't like a published chart or something like that. And there are things in the Bible that seem to indicate maybe you need to work off your sins. This is, what Luther found. And this is just like, a lifesaver going to somebody drowning at sea. And so you can see what he says here. And maybe, you've gone through some sort of life-changing thing where, like, you see something and there's this epiphany and says, oh, yeah, like, and then he goes racing through the Bible to find other things in it and whatever that would support this. So this becomes sort of the cornerstone of his faith, is the idea that it's faith alone that will save us, because there's no way we can save ourselves. But the church had these different ideas, and there's what's known. Is my time up? Huh?
I was wondering, what have we timed out there on the faith part?
And?
Well,
I went away.
We continue. Well, it doesn't have to be every
way. Yeah.
Thinking that that's a good pause point of faith.
Yeah,
is
okay.
Is there anything you want to get to that we could finish up that?
Okay. Do you want this?
No.
Okay. So can I keep it?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want this?
All right. No.
Keep this?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the hard part, because I'm the bell, and I don't want to be the bell. But in some ways, the part about stopping at faith, I think, is a good place to start, because that was where Paige was going with that. So I did cut Chris off in the middle. He has more slides, and he has more to share with us, so you should definitely ask him. But aren't we glad we didn't live back then? We have Bibles in our own language. We have the tables of communion that are open to each of us, and that the faith that they had in Hebrews, the people of faith that Paige talked about, and the faith that Martin Luther was excited about, that is the faith that all of those faiths together in God come together. Each of us is invited to the table where Jesus would like to meet with us. You are welcome to go as you are ready.